accession number 27229, Reel 6.
Bob Jones, Reel 6.
Yes.
Bob, you're saying you had one of your triumphs in the Pacific?
Yes, well, a sort of triumph. We were on this long trip back, and we were north of the equator in what you call the trade winds belt, where the wind's the same every day from the northeast, the weather's nice, fluffy clouds, and the sea is all goes the same way. And in the tropics, the barograph, that's the pressure recorder, behaves just like the tides. It goes up and down twice a day, regularly like that. And about late in the afternoon, I became aware that the wind had gone right round the west. The sea was getting confused because it was blowing the sea that way, and the sea was going that way, and it was blowing it that way. And that my barograph had failed to go up, and it had gone level. And I thought, and I realised we were in the latitude where typhoons start. So I thought it could be a typhoon starting up, with nothing being reported. And they're not very big when they start. And it couldn't have been more than 150 miles away. And from the direction of the wind and everything, I got my chart out, and I reckoned there was a typhoon just there, and I put my pencil on it. So I went to the captain, and I said, I think there's a typhoon started up. And there was a strict order all around the Pacific in those days that any ship, anybody encountering a typhoon, report immediately. So he said, I should go and have a word with the navigating officer. He said, he's been out here, he's a regular, been out here before. So I went to see the navigating officer, who was lying on his bunk like this, and the ship was beginning to roll a bit. He said, no. He said, it's out of season. Don't have typhoons now. He said, it's out of season. So I thought, well, that's it. Well, it 7 o'clock in the evening, radio message. American weather plane reports typhoon in position so-and-so. Exactly where I put my pencil point. And it was an out-of-season typhoon, and it was a big one. It went straight across Hong Kong. They had to put the fleet to sea. It demolished half the buildings. And that was my bloody typhoon. And I was entitled to it, and I was cheated. Imagine? As a Met officer, I think that was a brilliant bit of deduction, and I was very, very disappointed. So, off we went to Japan, and we toured around Japan. Some time we spent near, went into Tokyo. The experience there, the story was, of course, that there's shambles in Tokyo, in Japan. You can buy anything with a packet of cigarettes. Box of 50, you could have a brothel to yourself, sort of thing, So I didn't want to change anybody, and you could travel free in the train. So we went with another chap into Tokyo from Yokohama, from the naval base. So we just took a couple of packets of cigarettes with us in case we wanted anything. And so we walked around Tokyo. We got to the Emperor's Palace, and there was an old whiskery Japanese standing there selling picture postcards. So I thought, well, I could buy some picture postcards. So we offered him a pack of cigarettes with these picture postcards. He says, me no smoke. I said, well, bloody hell. I reckon I could have had the Emperor's concubine for this. And well, I got the postcards anyway, but so that was a funny experience. Not the same as other people, maybe, but I have to relate it as what happened. And then we went round into the Inland Sea of Japan, and I had another meteorological experience. We were going along quite nicely one morning, sun shining, and all of a sudden all hell went let loose. The wind got up, my wind recorder went right across the chart and jammed the other side. It was blowing the tarpaulins off the boats on the upper deck. The captain called down the voice boat, "What the hell is this?" And I could back, "I don't know, sir. Not on my chart." And I just didn't know what to do. And by the time I got up to the bridge, it had disappeared again. And the sun was out, and you wouldn't have known anything had happened. And there are things like that. It's kind of a line's call. It's too minute to appear on the weather map. And so the funny thing is, only a fortnight ago, one of the lessons at church was about Jesus asleep in the boat with the fishermen. And a great storm blew up, and they came sore afraid, and Jesus was asleep. And they woke him up and said, "We're afraid, we're all going to drown." And he got on and said, "Stop," you know, and it all stopped, you see. And I reckon it was one of those. And then we got round to the naval base at Kure, which was quite a sight because there were several of the Japanese battleships sunk or lying inside in the water. And that's only a short train ride from Hiroshima. So a group of us went round to Hiroshima to see what was left, and there wasn't anything really. Which is funny, a train goes into a station which had platforms and no buildings. And then we walked, did a long walk around the city, and it's where a river is near the sea, and a river split into a lot of channels with bridges over them. And much of the bridges were down. But there were some bridges where the trams were still running. And what puzzled me a bit, there were so many Japanese walking about. Where they were walking to or from, I have the foggiest idea. And we wondered if they would scowl at us, but they sort of grinned, and I think maybe just Japanese for scowling, I'm not sure. But we came to one bridge where the tram lines went across, and they were on sleepers. But the rest of the bridge had gone, it was shored up. And we thought, well, we could walk on these sleepers. And when you try to do that high above a river, it's very, very unpleasant, very giddy making. And I said, I wish we hadn't. We got halfway across, and the tram came on our track, and we had to jump down onto a gas main or something, and climb onto the next track. And of course, I was wearing my uniform, and I thought, I dare not let the king's uniform down by being terrified. But I was pretty terrified, I can tell you. Anyway, we did that. That was an experience, and it was really couldn't have been any worse for any of the reports you had. And then I had another meteorological experience. We were in that area, and one morning I was sent for by the admiral. So I went down to the admiral's cabin, and the captain was there, and he said, "Captain and I have been invited to a picnic ashore today, and we want to know what the weather's going to be like." And it was drizzling at the time. I said, "Well, can you give me a quarter of an hour, sir, so to get back to my Met office?" And so I went back to the Met office and tapped everything I'd got and looked at what apology for a weather chart had come through on the radio, and it wasn't much good. But I could see there was a kind of front across Japan, and it only wanted a puff of wind from China. It would be a gorgeous day, and without that it would be like this. And I thought, oh God. So I went back down to the admiral. "Right," he said, "what's it going to do?" I said, "It's going to rain all day, sir." He turned to the captain, he says "it's going to rain all day." Then he turned to me and said, "Would you go to the picnic if you were me?" And I just didn't have time to think. I said, "Yes, sir." "You've just said it's going to rain all day." I said, "Yes, but it'd do you good to get out of the ship." "Ah." Turned to the captain, he said, "Well, go." So they went, and it rained all day, and they had a bloody good time, and they all came back very happy. And I don't know how I came to say that. It was one of those reflexes, I suppose. And it was one of those things where I suppose I couldn't have gone wrong, because if it had been a lovely day, they wouldn't have complained. Whereas if I said it had been a lovely day and it had been Peter or rain all day, then they would have been upset. But I didn't have time to analyse it. But it was an experience, another metaphor's experience. Nobody else in the ship had that experience. And shortly after that, of course, the Admiral went home to a great sigh of relief. And we went off back down to Singapore for a longish refit, where I should have come home from there. And my relief was appointed eventually after about 6 weeks. And then couldn't get his release in time. So I ended up going back to Hong Kong again. And that's when I wrote the whole show of Radio Belfast for the last time, and got an offer from one of the passengers for an introduction to the BBC. Well, there we are. It's all good, clean fun.
So how did you come to leave the ship?
Well, I got a relief, who was a man, senior, much senior to me, who'd been on the staff at King Alfred. But, you see, once the Admiral had gone home, there was a big reorganisation, and Belfast, after this refit in Singapore, was going back to Hong Kong to be the fleet flagship. There wouldn't be any more battleships anymore. And so we're getting a vice admiral, sort of a rear admiral, and they obviously wanted some more senior people. But in any case, my time was regarded as up anyway. So I was relieved by a much more senior chap to be in my place, who, George Shepherd, I kept in touch with until he died a few years ago, and I'm still in touch with his widow in Devon. We visited very often, so... He was a career man and stayed on and finally retired as a commander. But always had that that contact with him, of taking over for me in the Belfast. Because when I was... one of the things we did was, as a schooling, I used to run quiz competitions in the ship, one part of the ship against another. And I got the signal bloke to run me up a fake academic gown, a black gown and a mortarboard, and, which I would wear. And when my relief came, I presented him with the gown and the mortarboard to take over. And so I eventually came home in the HMS Tyne as a passenger. It was a destroyer depot ship. It took 6 weeks to get home, about 12 knots, and... all I could do was to just cut notches in a stick for every day that went by, thinking I'm going to see my daughter for the first time, who was by this time, I don't know, she was about 6 months old, 7 months old. And but I've often thought since, I had no duties. All I did was once to participate in putting on another show. It's a fake radio show. And there I was, 6 weeks, a cruise, no work, all meals found, and just wishing it away. There it was. I got home, and Belfast was a memory. But
were you demobilised at that time?
No, I had another about 6 months to go, and I was hoping to do something in the current affairs thing. Because I haven't told you about that, it was quite a big thing in the ship. But in the end, they badly needed a senior met officer at a naval air station in Pembrokeshire, Dale. So I was posted down there, and they said, "You lucky devil, Pembrokeshire, you're going there for the winter, you know, from October till Easter. All those spring flowers and early potatoes and everything." Well, I was there for that terrible winter of 1947. And we had 6 foot snowdrifts, and I was the Met officer, so it was my bloody fault. Anyway, and my wife was with me. We got two rooms in the cottage, and we were practically frozen stiff. We ran out of coal. We'd had about a pint of oil for a paraffin primer stove. it was horrendous. But anyway, that was my the last show. But I'd like to tell you about the current affairs thing, because
by all means,
the recommendation, one of these things that tends to be made centrally, which can't be done, is that every serviceman should have 15 minutes a week of current affairs. Well, you try and organise that anywhere. I said, well, we're a ship. But I've been very impressed by the fact that I've been sent on a one-week course. I had nothing else to do, and I was just immersed in this, and it was really lit me up, you know. So I cooked up this proposal to the captain, which I typed out on the way to Australia after the bomb had dropped, and I thought I might be able to get something done now, that I'd like to have about 20 chaps at a time, detailed off, not volunteered, detailed off from all over the ship, for excuse all duties for 2 days, and just to have a current affairs course, nothing else to do for 2 days, two mornings, two afternoons, and a mixture of people from chief petty officers down to ordinary seamen and so on. So I put in the report to the captain, who said, I think this is a excellent idea and I will give it my full support, which of course, if your captain says that, you're all right. If he doesn't, you've had it. And I had this sort of captain. So he issued that this should take place when we could got a settled period. So it's started while we were at Shanghai. And I remember the first course, there was a bit of tooth-sucking went on. Anyway, these chaps were gathered in the operations room, which was no longer needed as an operations room. So I thought, well, I'll go to the captain, tell him it was sort of organised and the first course was ready to start. So he said, would you like me to come down and say a few words? I said, that'd be very kind, thank you very much. He telescope under his arm, put his cap on and came down. And he gave a marvellous 2 or 3 minute introduction to me, how this was very valuable, that they were all going home to civilian life, most of them, and it was a valuable experience. They're all going to be making decisions about politics and things and so on. And he just gave me this start. And whether it would have been a success without, I don't know, but it was a great success. And we ran up to 20 or more of them altogether, got through about 500 of the ship's company before I finally had to give them up. And I had as lecturers other officers with special experiences. One of the warrant officers actually came and gave a lecture on the Palestine problem, as if we haven't still got one, but as it was then, before Israel was set up. And he'd lived there for a bit, that's why. The Captain of Marines gave a talk on the Indian problem, because he'd lived in India. Principal Medical Officer, Surgeon Commander, gave a talk on the proposed National Health Service. I gave talk on post-year education. I used to give lectures on Parliament. I'd learnt it all up. And British Imperial History and the history of where we were. And we had discussion groups. They all had to give a five-minute talk. Things like that. And it ended up with a brain trust with the staff in the pillory, and they could ask any questions they wanted to. And then they were all given a sheet, a questionnaire, saying which you're invited to give your opinion of this, that and the other part of the course. You need not put your name on, but if you do, I'll be happy. There's a box on my cabin door with my name on, with a slot in it, and if we're very pleased to have your reactions to anything. And I had lots of them back, and all very, very complimentary, and I've still got them in the garage. I've got all the old current affairs programs, and you'll find a sample one in the book there, and a reproduction of my letter. And finally, at Sydney, I was asked by the Fleet Education Officer if I'd write it all up for him, but I averted all that for him, and the captain sent it via the Admiral to the Admiralty, and the Admiralty published effectively, without giving my name or the name of the ship, as an example of what can be done in a cruiser. And it went out to the entire Royal Navy, and I've still got that somewhere. So I was chuffed about that. It was one thing I really created. I mean, I didn't create the job of Met Officer, it was just God created the weather, but I felt it was one thing I really had invented. It's never been done before in a warship, and it worked. And so I was very, very thrilled about that.
So when you got back and you'd gone to Pembrokeshire, how did you come to leave the Navy?
Well, I was due for demob round about Easter, I knew. But a strange thing happened. I'd been there at Dale with the Met Office job about 2 months, I think it was. And I had a phone call from the Admiralty, from the Education Department, from the Admiral's sidekick, who was also a man at King Alfred on the staff there, who I knew, a career officer, who later became the Rear Admiral himself. And he rang me up and he said, we'd be very interested if you'd like to sign on, stay on in the Navy. But he said, if you do, he said, there's a job we'd want you to do. And it could be a bit urgent. I said, what is it? Well, he said, they want a lecturer in mathematics and navigation at the Royal Australian Naval College in Melbourne. But it's a bit urgent and you might have to fly out quite soon. So I said, well, when do you want to know? He said, well, you couldn't say now, could you? I said, no, I'm bloody well. I can't speak to my wife about this. So I went back to the cottage and told my wife about it. And she's always wonderful support. She said, you must do what you want to do. And I thought, I've been back long from the Far East, and I can't bloody well go out there again and leave them there. So I rang back the next morning. I said, well, it's nice of you to think of me, but I think I'll take my DMOB, you see, which I did. But a couple of weeks after that took place, the air station was visited by the head of education of the Australian Navy, who was actually a civilian. I don't know why we visited, but he came and had dinner. I had dinner with him. And I told him about this. He said, oh, you're the chap they wanted, are you? I said, yes. Why didn't you take it? I said, well, I had not been back. And from there, I'd only just seen my daughter for the first time. I just didn't. I said, there was a great hurry anyway. He said, there's no hurry. I said, who's going? He said, Lieutenant Commander Tidy. He's about 10 years my senior. And he hasn't gone yet, and he's going by sea. Oh, I said, well, anyway, I just didn't feel I could just go off and leave the family when I'd just seen them again. Oh, he said, they could have gone with you. We'd have given you a house. I said, nobody said that. And quite honestly, I mean, I got a job as a lecturer in chemistry at Leeds College of Technology. Well, I was very happy. And we bought our first house. But sometimes I used to lean on my spade in the garden and think, there's a tide in the affairs of men. And I may have missed it. Because I think if they'd said, you could all go and you'd have a house, I liked the Navy. I thought the Navy was a good outfit. And I think I might have gone. Life would be quite difficult, different. So that's how it turned. But the funny thing is that this chap became the Rear Admiral himself. And when he retired, he became the Deputy Director of the South Bank Polytechnic. when I expected him. Shortly before I retired. And I thought that was quite funny, really. And I would have had a different life, wouldn't I? I don't know that I would have liked the Navy so much when I say in peacetime, but, you know, all the ships were going. I might have not gone to sea again. And I did like the Navy in a ship. You know, there's a feeling of community in a ship. And I, of course, I missed my wife like hell. But, and I wanted to be with the family, so there it was. That's what we've done.
One last question, Bob.
Yeah.
Was Belfast a happy ship?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
What made her a happy ship?
Captain. Oh, that's my view. I mean, the other senior officers were, I would say, very nice chaps. There wasn't a single, you know, bad-tempered one amongst them. But the captain makes all the difference. I think he was a wonderful chap, and he became a rear admiral eventually, but of course obviously he wouldn't go much further, so the Navy could have collapsed on itself. But when Belfast was brought into the Thames, I got an invitation to the ceremony, and I turned up, and there was the captain in civvies, of course, with the bowler hat, and the commander and the gunnery officer and one of the sub-lieutenants. And we walked around the ship together, and I had a nice chat with the captain. And I was able to thank him for something, because I told you about when he came and started my current affairs course. Now, in technical colleges, before I went into the inspectorate, the powers that be essentially decided technical students needed education, more, bit broader education, so they would have to have liberal studies. And so they inserted liberal studies into all the technical courses. And of course, most of these, especially the part-time students who came one day a week and two evenings, sort of was a bloody waste of time, really. But when I realised this could be very, could be done well, but with my current affairs background, but still. When we started up in my college, I was head of science, and I deliberately went with the general studies lecturer to the first lecture to my students and introduced him and did a 2-minute start, like my captain did for me. And I thought, it's the least I owe him, because there was this set of blokes sucking their teeth, you see. And that was a wonderful experience for me, and I was able to thank him personally. Then, years later, when I came down here and I was going to London frequently, I managed to look him up and found he was living in Belgravia, and got in touch, and he invited me to lunch in his flat, Tom Penthouse flat, and he took me out to lunch. And he was very, very friendly and very nice. And he said, well, we must carry on meeting. So I was on a lot of committees in London, and I used to go on an early train and go and have coffee with him first. And I did that till he died in his early 90s. And he was such a wonderful chap, really. I just count myself lucky that I served under him. And I would have to say thank you. And I picked up something from him, I hoped.
Well, thank you, Bob. That's great.
All right.
Thank you.